The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome Philip Gorevich.
Ooh, thank you. Thanks for coming out on this fine day. And it's nice to be here warming up for Barbara Walters. Always how I thought it would end. If you're here for James McBride's talk just before mine, it was a great writer, and it's very nice of him to have said all those nice things. I'll try and give you a chance to get a sense of what this book about Abu Ghraib, this that I've got here with me, is about, and why I undertook it, and to ask me some questions. I find that people tend to have them. I certainly did. That's why I got involved in this. Like a lot of you, 4 years ago, when the pictures first appeared from Abu Ghraib prison in the press on 60 Minutes and in the New Yorker magazine, there was a sense of shock and perplexity and wondering, in some sense, what I was looking at. The verdict was pretty quick. People pretty quickly said, we know what we're looking at. In The Economist magazine, for instance, a magazine that had supported the war in Iraq and thought it was the right thing to do and so forth without supporting every detail of it, had on its cover the famous picture of the hooded man with wires coming from his fingers and the headline, Rumsfeld Resign. The connection between the photographs and the highest level of policy was immediately apparent, and yet, as more of the pictures came out, it very quickly became a distraction. The pictures themselves became less an expose than a vehicle of hiding what they showed, because we became preoccupied with the people who took them, with the soldiers, the so-called bad apples, with the idea that this was a group of rogues, that it was a group of aberrant behavior, and that the pictures themselves were the offense, rather than the things that they depicted. I was covering the presidential election in 2004 at the time that these came out. I was writing about it for the New Yorker magazine, traveling around, following both candidates. And one of those candidates was running for re-election, largely in defense of the war that he'd started, entirely of his own initiative. One thought at the time that this would, I assumed that this would become a kind of central issue, a central debate in the campaign. Here, the Abu Ghraib pictures, the larger policy that emerged in the news and in the reporting around that, that the country had decided, as a matter of state policy, to use violent tactics against detainees, the whole detention complex that was building around the world, there was a kind of floodgate of leaked documents that started to come out, particularly in the wake of the publication and broadcast of the photographs. And I was kind of amazed as the campaign went on that it was never brought up. It was not brought up, as you might imagine, by the president, but it wasn't brought up by the opposition candidate, such as he was as an oppositionist either. And it really just kind of vanished. And then over the ensuing year and a quarter, half a dozen to a dozen of the lowest-ranking soldiers in the military were sent to jail for prison terms that exceed the terms that people who have been convicted of murder in the military usually get. For things like taking these pictures and appearing in them. Nobody over the rank of staff sergeant was ever prosecuted in a court-martial, although enormous documentation linked these acts to policy. And nobody, in fact, who was not a reservist was prosecuted. And it was basically swept under the rug with the people who appeared in the photographs or who took them. There was only one soldier who was convicted, who had not actually physically appeared in a photograph. And so the photographs, instead of being a window through which, that soldier was present at the time that the photographs were being taken. He was so associated with the particular incidents in the photographs that that's why he was taken as well. But the photographs, instead of providing us a window onto a much larger complex and moment in our history that to much of the world had suddenly redefined us dramatically, and to many of us at home, the photographs became a kind of pinhole that shut. And what was outside the photographs was kind of off the table. If you weren't in the photographs, it wasn't the story. If it wasn't in the photographs, it wasn't to be discussed and examined. And that was very puzzling to me. And I was troubled by it and wondered how one might get at it at times. And about a year and a half ago, in the summer of 2006, my friend, the filmmaker Errol Morris, started sending me transcripts of interviews he'd been conducting with some of these soldiers, particularly with the soldiers who had appeared in or taken the photographs, who had started being released from prison after serving some or all of their time. Not some of them are still in jail to this day, but those who were coming out, he was managing to get interviews with, and conversations that were really completely extraordinary, that were hundreds of thousands of words long, which means longer than this book, many of the interview transcripts. And I was starting to read these, and what I was hearing was something I had not heard at all from the entire Iraq War, and really from this period of American history. It was the voices of ordinary American soldiers. These were mostly reservists. They were mostly from extreme southwestern Pennsylvania and Maryland and West Virginia area. They were from a reserve unit based in Cresaptown, Maryland. And they had been the ones who were charged with being the guards on this particular prison block where they were putting so-called high-value detainees, that is to say, prisoners taken during the insurgency in Iraq by American forces who thought that these prisoners had intelligence value for interrogation, and they were being held pending interrogation. And these were the soldiers who had come into the war, had come into soldiering without expecting to go into a war. They were mostly reservists who had been in service for several years, many of them trying to pay for college with a degree of patriotism and service, either in their family tradition or in their own ideals. Many of them were looking for a way out of different aspects of dead-end lives, or I don't mean to say totally dead-end, but with very few opportunities for advancement, and whether it would be through education or employment. And they were not trained as military prison guards at all. They were trained as combat MPs, doing combat support logistics, driving convoys, and so forth. They'd started the war, being sent in shortly after the president declared major combat on May 1st. They'd been sent in to a town called Al-Hilla, which is in southern Iraq, south of Baghdad. It's a mostly Shiite city. It's near the ancient city of Babylon. They had been quite welcomed there. It was a town which Saddam had ruled particularly harshly, which had had some resistance. When you heard about mass graves being found of Saddam's victims in the immediate aftermath of the war, a lot of them were found there in Al-Hilla. As a result, the people who lived there had lost a lot under him and were willing to give the Americans, if not the kind of welcome that the most vaunted propaganda had put forward in anticipation, a reasonable welcome. But it was pretty disorganized there, too. But they'd had a good war, as it were, for those first 2-3 months. They'd lived in an unfortified quarters in a former date factory. They had a pretty good record in the town. There had been no significant problems. There'd been minor discipline problems, mostly in the form of soldiers who were having affairs with other soldiers and whom nobody in the unit really cared about that happening. But it meant that there was a sort of breakdown of some of the basic rules and order. And then they were sent to Abu Ghraib prison, where they arrived in early October of 2003. And when they arrived at Abu Ghraib, they knew nothing about the place. They did not know that it had been the centerpiece of Saddam's prison system and his gulag, that it had been the place where where hundreds of people were executed every week during his rule, that it had been cracked open before the Americans arrived. Saddam had liberated all of the prisoners in a kind of bizarre sabotage of the invasion in advance. He had simply emptied all of the prisons in his country on one day, which, considering how feared these had been, was an extremely bold and bizarre move that left everybody a little unsettled and also meant there were about 125,000, many of them actual criminals, ex-convicts who had spent their lives in the hardest circumstances, who were let out, many of them armed, to then resist the Americans, and who, in the kind of twisted logic of imprisonment and release, many of them were, when they got out, felt indebted to Saddam rather than merely opposed to him, which they had been before. They arrive at this prison and they discover that it's in the heart of the Sunni triangle. It's at the absolute epicenter between Fallujah and Baghdad and Ramadi of the heartland of the resistance that's building into a pretty ragged insurgency by the fall of 2003. They, trained as combat MPs, assume that they're being sent up to the prison to kind of help defend the prison, that they'll be doing some raids and operations all around the prison to help secure it, because it was under constant attack. A couple weeks before they arrived, a mortar attack, and the mortar attacks were coming in over the walls all day long. They were basically like fish in a barrel. They could not see, except from the guard towers, out. And at night, mortars would be coming into the prison. Most of the prisoners were being held in tented camps, and prisoners were killed or maimed by incoming fire on a regular basis. And the soldiers themselves were under attack, and several of them had been killed, military intelligence interrogators specifically, and radio people in the days before the 372nd MP unit arrived. Now, there's a rule by which the American military runs prisons. And prisons are always interesting, I should say. We know that de Tocqueville, when he came here and wrote the big book on American democracy, studied American prisons with great care. People have always found that if you study prisons, you learn a lot about it, the way a society understands and defines itself in the world. George Washington, after the Battle of Princeton, seized hundreds of Hessian soldiers who had been fighting against us on behalf of the British. And he immediately put out the order that we would not have the same rules that the British had when they took American prisoners. When they took Continental soldiers, the British killed them out in captivity or allowed them to die with absolutely no care in captivity. That was considered okay by their rules of war. Washington said, we will not do that, and he forbade that and insisted on humane and decent treatment for all captives in the Revolutionary War. And it was a tremendously powerful move for him to do. It defined on some very important idea of what being American was. It won us considerable foreign support. A lot of the Hessians, when they were released, ended up staying and becoming Americans rather than going home. I mean, from a kind of global public opinion point of view, it really struck a chord. People had the feeling this was something different. And when people talk about the treatment of prisoners one way or the other as being American or un-American these days, it's not just an abstract notion. It's not just a self-congratulatory notion. It actually speaks to a very, very deep tradition. The rules of military prison keeping are based on the Geneva Conventions. And a lot of people think, oh, the Geneva Conventions, that sounds sort of Swiss or French and foreign and weird, and probably it's some sort of international law that's trying to take our sovereignty away. But the fact is they are the bedrock of American military doctrine. And American military doctrine actually explicitly states, if there's ever a conflict between Geneva and our rules, Geneva is superior. We defer to it. Geneva's very first premise is when you capture a prisoner, you must take them somewhere safe. You cannot hold a prisoner in a combat zone. So far from what you saw simply in the photographs from Abu Ghraib, the entire existence of this prison, which was 280 acres of territory with five separate complexes and all of these tented camps, what in a combat zone was illegal, inappropriate, and that's a problem not just out of the niceties of things in battle, but also because if you're trying to protect people as a prison guard, and if you're trying to contain your own emotion and so forth, it helps if you're not being shot at. And it helps if they're not being shot at. And if you don't see them as the people who are shooting at you at that very, very moment. So you have this extremely dangerous combat zone situation where you also had these guards were told, and now here's the cell block where military intelligence is keeping the worst of the worst prisoners. And they walked in, and there were prisoners chained naked to the bars, prisoners with panties on their heads, prisoners in extremely painful stress positions. And they were given instructions right away, keep them up all night. This one's on a 4 hours of sleep out of every 20 hours for 72 hours sleep deprivation schedule. We have environmental manipulation. You can change their food. You can spray them with water. You can cause them, this kind of pain, that kind of pain. You can inflict them. You can put them in a dark room and play loud music, and I mean really loud music, blasting into their cell to disorient and distress them for hours and hours on end and keep them up all night. These practices, which later got attributed to our rogue soldiers, were in place when they arrived and were, most strikingly, inscribed in a series of orders that had basically evolved from the highest levels of the administration through Rumsfeld's orders for Guantanamo Bay of interrogation approaches, and then been brought by the general who was running Guantanamo Bay, General Jeffrey Miller, to Abu Ghraib, where the commander of all ground forces in Iraq at the time, General Ricardo Sanchez, he and his lawyers created a draft set of rules, and then they made everything even more confusing by putting out five sets of rules in the course of a month, and each one replacing the last and changing what was allowed a little bit, that allowed exploitation of the Arab fear of dogs, environmental manipulation, sleep deprivation, darkness, light, food, all of the things that you saw and heard about. They were mandated. Now, Ricardo Sanchez has a book out now telling you that although he was the commander of everybody in Iraq, everything was the fault of people below him or above him, which is how things work these days. In Nuremberg, it was determined that just following orders wasn't an adequate excuse, but nowadays it's become just giving orders seems to be the best alibi that anybody can come up with. And you really see it going down on the littlest soldier, which is another thing that struck me when I started hearing these transcripts, which is this was the voice of the little guy. And there was an un-American element in this story, and Errol Morris often talks about this as well, that almost in the Frank Capra film sense of it, which is we think that we don't like to treat our captives this way. We don't like to project ourselves inhumanely into the world. But we also like to think the little guy shouldn't get stuck being held accountable for the policies of power. So people sometimes say, well, are you making excuses for these terrible people we see in the photographs? Didn't they show pleasure? Didn't they get enthusiastic? The only reason that any of them did what they did there is because it was allowed, encouraged, and requested of them. Now, if some of them got into it and others resisted a little more, that gets into the complexity and mystery of human beings. But if it had been forbidden and if military discipline had been in place and if that had not been our policy, these things would not have happened. So what struck me listening to these voices as I first heard them was really that this is a war story in the old tradition of a group of people being sent into a place where a set of conditions pertain, and that in the whole debate, as it were, about torture in this country, it's been made into a kind of partisan issue. It's been made into an issue where it's really about, is this what we want to be doing to them? And some people say, look, they blew up our buildings, they cut off our heads when we go over there. Sure. You know, if it saves lives, got no problem with it. And other people say, we must never do such things to people. That's not who we are. And I started to think, maybe the debate's all wrong. Maybe this is all allowing us in some ways to look away, because all of this is being done in our name, in the name of our liberty, our freedom, our security. And maybe what we really need to be asking, is this what we want to do to ourselves? And that's what I felt when I tried to tell this story, or when I've told this story through the voices of these soldiers who were most directly involved. It's an attempt in some way to create the uncomfortable claustrophobia of the experience that they had and that one can't fully not identify with when one gets close to it. I'm going to finish my little speaking part here, I thought, by giving you just a sense of what they sound like from towards the end of the book, rather than giving you all the details of the story right now, and then I'll take your questions. The book is divided into three fairly unequal parts in length, before, during, and after. Before is simply the period of May 1, 2003, when the president declared the end of major combat, until our soldiers arrive at the prison in October. And it's an important period because you may remember the famous mission accomplished speech on the aircraft carrier, which was much mocked as premature triumphalism and became kind of a bone of contention in the election. But it was actually a very skilled piece of political theater because everybody got distracted by the president with his thumb up, surrounded by people in red jumpsuits on the deck of the aircraft carrier and mission accomplished and all of this. But the speech itself was crucial. If you really read it, and I went back and read it, it was astonishing. 90% of the speech was not about Iraq. It was about the war on terror, and it was about folding Iraq into the war on terror and the long war and the enduring war. And what does that mean? Well, it's very important because the rules of the war on terror were that the Geneva Conventions don't apply. That major combat is what you have when you fight another state. Saddam Hussein, his government, and his army. They're gone. Now who's our enemy? Our enemy are these illegal combatants. Our enemy are the terrorists. This is a different legal structure that was being pivoted to in that speech. And during is the story of the prisoners during the time that they were there. And after, I begin with this quote that I came across from the French writer Jean-Paul Sartre, where he said, "Happy are those who died without ever having had to ask themselves, if they tear out my fingernails, will I talk? But even happier are others who have not had to ask themselves that other question, If my friends, fellow soldiers, and leaders tear out an enemy's fingernails in my presence, what will I do? And some of the characters in the book, I just had them talk at the end. Javal Davis was a soldier who had been a prison guard there for a while, who did not like what he was asked to do, who also confessed right away that he had at times shown quite a bit of violence to some of the prisoners and tried to hurt them when he was mad at them. And he was convicted, and he says, "So a big chunk of my life is gone. I can never get back. And the privacy that I had, never going to get it back, that was stripped from me. Marriage, destroyed. I was ostracized on national television, you know. For what? To cover up someone's lives. To cover up our tactics, procedures that no one wants to own up to. My son still thinks that I was at work. He's still too young. I'll explain to him later on down the line, you know. My daughter, she knows. I explained it to her, and she understood. She won't be joining the military. I don't want to be a cop anymore. I'm done. I'm in sales. The career path that I have now, you know, comfortable. I deal with people on the regular basis. I'm not handling anyone's problems. I'm not dealing with anything violent. So I'm business to business. All personal. How you doing? I'm Javal Davis. Nice to meet you. Everyone's happy. I like that. Sales. I'm a salesman. It's a hot potato, Abu Ghraib. Tim Dugan, who was a civilian interrogator under contract at Abu Ghraib, said. I mean, what good can come out of it for a politician to go in defense of somebody from Abu Ghraib? Is there any goodness that could come out of that for his political career? They're going to rip the person apart who was there. Whatever your justification, whatever you did, you're wrong. You're part of Abu Ghraib. I was really proud of everything I did at Abu Ghraib, and now I'm ashamed to mention I was even there. It's a no-win scenario. If you wrote a book, it would have to be fiction because nobody would believe any of this shit. I was there, and I don't believe this shit. I sit here and shake about it, talking to you, and I hyperventilate when I'm talking about it. Post-traumatic stress. You always feel guilty, Sabrina Harmon said. She is a young woman who took a lot of the photographs that became the infamous and iconic photographs of the war and defined that experience. And she had been an aspiring forensic photographer before she got deployed to Iraq. You always feel guilty, she said, thinking you could have changed something, or I guess dereliction of duty for not reporting something that went on, even though people did know. I guess you could have went to somebody else. So I accept the dereliction of duty charge. Personally, I accept that one. It would be nice just to put everything behind me. It sucks, but it's a learning experience, I guess. It helps you grow, getting screwed over. I don't know. I really don't know what I want to do. I'll just get my degree in photography, and that's it for right now. I spent 2 years of my life as a soldier in Vietnam, Lane McCotter said. He was a consultant who was sent over by the Justice Department in the beginning of the summer of 2003 to help build a proper modern civilian correction system in Iraq. And he's the man who identified Abu Ghraib as a prison we should reopen before it was then taken over by the military, and his whole idea of it was scotched. And on one of those years, I literally lived with the Vietnamese 24 hours a day. Only because of politics, we lost the war. For what, 12, 13 years and over 50,000 soldiers' lives? Many of them were good friends of mine. I see some parallels, I think, to what's happening in Iraq sometimes, and it frightens me. Our interpreters, we became very good friends. A couple of them cried when I came home. Why are you going home? You're going to leave? Are all the Americans going to leave? That was their biggest fear. I just hope that we don't pull out on them like we did on the Vietnamese. Americans seem to get impatient. How are we going to get to the truth when the truth holders are clamming up and won't talk? Ken Davis, a sergeant in military intelligence, said. Am I un-American for saying I don't want to watch my children go to jail for following orders when the officers are cowards and won't stand up for the orders that they gave? I told my wife, I said, you know, it's hard to think that out of all of this, people can start to believe that the lie is the truth and the truth is the lie. It's like a shadow game. Me and my children, we play hide and seek. And I finally got my girls to play hide and seek in the dark. And they say, Daddy, why are you playing in the dark? And I said, because look. You see what's in the light, right? But you can't see what's in the dark, and you can move around. You can hide. The shadow game. That's what I believe these administration types in them do. They hide in the shadows. They have different people do what they want to do, and then they just disappear. Gary DeLand was a colleague of Lane McCotter's who was the prison consultant. They were both former prison commissioners in Utah. When I got back, the first time I drove the car, I'm driving over to my brother's house. As I'm approaching, the light turns red for me, Gary DeLand said. Green for the other side. And two cars are going through the intersection. And it was the perfect matchup that I would get when I was in Iraq, where you drive as hard as you can at the back end of the one car so that without hitting them, you roll off the back bumper of both cars, and you don't have to stop if you do it right. So instead of slowing down for the red light, I geared down on my Camaro and punched it, and I was flying into this intersection right at these two cars. And my wife screamed, and it woke me up, and I slammed on the brakes and slid sideways into the intersection. She says, "What in the hell were you doing?" I said, "Well, they were lined up perfect for me." To transition home was very difficult for me. I would say, "I'm going to lay down for a minute," and I wake up 24 hours later. We went to visit some friends that we spend a week every summer with on their lake in Georgia. Got in, said, "I'm going to lay down for a minute." That was 11 o'clock. I woke up at 11 o'clock that night. I mean, I couldn't function. I had depression. It sounds strange, but I missed greatly being in Iraq. I really felt good about what we did over there. You know, it also bothered me greatly that we had had difficulty getting some of the Iraqi prison guards we trained to stay with us, because we explained to them, you can't shake down families, you can't use brutality, you can't do this, you can't do that, and now all of a sudden, it was Americans that were doing it. So everything we were telling these people, now they're going to say, well, those hypocritical SOB Americans. My name was a good name in the military until I did what I did, Jeremy Sivitz said. Jeremy Sivitz was a mechanic in the MP unit, and he went one night over to the hard side area where the detainees were held and where the photographs were taken, and it happened to be the night when, which you probably know from the photographs of the human pyramid, where prisoners who were brought in naked were stacked on top of each other and photographs were taken. And Sivitz was there for about 2 hours, and during that time he saw a man punched in the chest and go unconscious, and he called medics and brought medical attention to that guy. And then he saw another guy who had flexi cuffs on his wrists so tight that his hands appeared to be losing their color, and he cut them off with his Gerber knife, and he stood around and watched the rest of what went on. And for that, he, as the lowest-ranking soldier and the one with the least direct involvement, he was the first one who was prosecuted 4 years ago, and he was given a year in prison and stripped of all of his military standing. My name was a good name in the military until I did what I did, Jeremy Sivitz said. My uncle died in Vietnam 13 years to the day till I was born. My dad had 2 bronze stars for valor in Vietnam. My grandfather's got a bronze star from Vietnam. And then I come along and get involved in that. That just put that name in the mud. I had always wanted to make my father proud, because the whole time I was growing up, I felt that he wasn't completely proud of me. I was pretty good on the baseball field. I was having a couple colleges, junior colleges and stuff, looking at me and things like that. And I was really concentrating on trying to get a baseball scholarship and things. And then when it didn't work out, I went into the military, and I seen how proud he was the night I come home with my enlistment papers. I wanted to do nothing more than be a combat veteran, just like my dad and my uncle and my grandfather. I wanted to walk in their shoes and be part of them. I wanted to be a combat veteran. And the night that I called and told my parents that I was in trouble, the only words I could say to my dad was, "Please don't disown me." All I wanted was to get that honorable discharge and have that combat veteran status, and to be able to say that I did my job, just like my dad did and my uncle and my grandfather, but unfortunately I didn't. And I think that's why I felt so embarrassed. These stories may sound as if the embarrassment was entirely personal. Obviously, the embarrassment was national and international. And there's been a lot of questions about what this war, in fact, in Iraq has been about. A lot of reasons were given. Not too many of them have held up. Maybe none. But one thing that it was about, and in a vague but unambiguous way, was about who we are and how America wants to project its force and its image into the world. It was about a kind of idea of what we can do for others. There was, once the WMD weren't found in particular, it became much more just presented as a war of liberation and a war in which we would be spreading our values and projecting ourselves. And these photographs, I think, have stuck with me and seem to me something that we should consider again, or the story around them, because they are the image of this war. They are the iconic photographs of this war. They're as important as the flag raising on Mount Suribachi at Iwo Jima, I'm afraid. And they tell you of a very different kind of war and a very different moment. And as I say, they do ask you, in some sense, why we're doing this to ourselves as much as why we're doing this to anybody else. And my sense, it's been puzzling to me at times. We've had very nice reviews of the book in the last couple days as it's been coming out. Most of them say good things. But the tendency is to describe it, in a sense, as a policy book, to describe the policy and the way that the policy was crafted from the high levels of the administration and how it was their responsibility and how Washington made this happen. And that's in there. It's in there in a couple of chapters. These voices and these soldiers and the specific detail of each moment, I realize that it's difficult in some ways to tell a story or to paraphrase a story that is that's all about individual characters. It's much closer in that sense, I suppose, to the way that a novel works. People are not entirely uniform. People are not entirely predictable. Circumstances are responded to differently. And what I was hoping to do, and what this book is an effort to do, is to show what policy looks like on the ground, not in abstract memoranda, not in legal briefs, not in arguments amongst people who are basically not necessarily telling it straight on Capitol Hill or in the press, but by people who are sent out, as I said, in our name, and who find themselves at a place where everything that they essentially had thought was expected is no longer expected, and a combination of fear and claustrophobia and orders leads to something that, sadly, is not an isolated chapter, but has become increasingly our policy since then. So I'm happy to go on all by myself, but if you have questions, I'd be happier responding to those. I will call on those who raise their hands, and these ladies will present you with microphones. Please. Yes.
The defense, it seems that there were so many lower people involved. Couldn't they collaborate and, you know, collectively say these were our orders? I mean,
the orders are quite clear. I mean, what you have is there was a lot going on. As I say, it was going on before they got there, and it was what they were told to do on arrival was to continue the practices of treating these particular detainees in this way. And these practices were then are in a set of rules of engagement for interrogation, rules of engagement put out by the legal shop and the headquarters of the ground command in Iraq. And they were loose in some of their respects. In other words, they say, here's what you're allowed to do, but they don't tell you how to do it. In other words, if it says keep somebody up for 24 hours, or 4 out of 20 hours, it doesn't say you may use the following 5 things to keep them up, but you may not do these things to keep them up. So there was a lot of latitude deliberately put into this. And there's a combination of orders and atmosphere, obviously. Many of these soldiers, some of the pictures were taken by soldiers who wanted to show them to higher-ups and say, look, this is where we're at. This is what's going on. Is this all right? And the photographs were seen by a lot of people, and nobody made any objection at all. There's no evidence of any objection. On the contrary, there are the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is different from like the local Red Cross. It's the Swiss Red Cross. And they're charged specifically with visiting prisons around the world, and particularly military prisons, and looking into Geneva enforcement and whether Geneva's being upheld. And they go in, and their whole deal is a little bit like Swiss banks. They only, you know, total client confidentiality. So they come, and they report entirely to the people who run the prisons. And they never leak. It never gets out to the press. They reported repeatedly in the fall of 2003 that they were finding prisoners held naked, bound, with their wrists shackled to the point of pain and scarring, in completely substandard and inappropriate conditions. Tantamount to torture was the phrase that they used themselves. And they would get responses from headquarters, from the lawyers in General Sanchez's legal shop, saying, this just sounds like a fantasy of yours. We don't know what you're talking about. And they stonewalled them. And they hid prisoners. They went to the prison in advance of Red Cross visits to actually hide prisoners whom they wanted them not to see from them during their inspections. So there was a deliberate attempt that you can trace that's shown in a mixture of documents and testimony, and that tracks from the very beginning forward, that shows that these guards were not sort of inventing all of this stuff out of the depravity of their own strange clubbiness. And that's how these things work. I mean, I've written a book about the Rwandan genocide, and one of the ways that the leaders of the Rwandan genocide wanted you to think that it happened was that ordinary people rose up and started slaughtering their neighbors and behaving in these depraved ways because they were uneducated peasants and so forth, which is not how uneducated peasants behave. People do these things when they're licensed to do them. And what you see in these rules is there's a mixture of actual do this, and there's also a lot of license created. What the way the militaries work is by sort of the vigorous discipline of young people and channeling their violence towards a very focused target or containing it altogether. And there's a concept called command responsibility, which is that every officer is responsible for those beneath him and responsible to those above him. And it goes down to this stuff that sounds silly, like, are your shoes shined? If your shoes aren't shined, one of the reasons I'm going to get on your case is because I don't want the guy above me getting on my case because my soldier's shoes aren't shined. So if you have a system like that in place, it's supposed to mean that if I see my soldiers behaving like this, I'm going to stop them, unless it's allowed and intended, because it'll come down on me. And what happens is, unfortunately, in the way that our army works now, in the climate that had been created in Iraq, you actually start to see that aspects of command responsibility get twisted into a kind of omerta. And everybody becomes, like, I'll cover up for you if you cover, because I don't want a problem. It's instead of making a hard time for you, I'll cover up for you. Then the guy above me won't have a problem. And you see how this whole organism works and left these young guys out to dry. Ma'am?
Something new in wars with the United States, and is it because of the president we have now?
Yeah, it is something new on one very important level. It's certainly not the first time in war, specifically in our wars, that American soldiers and American intelligence operatives have been involved in dirty business. We know that. Vice President Dick Cheney calls it sort of, you know, we're operating on the dark side. Shortly after September 11th, he said, you know, we're going to have to spend a lot more time in the shadows working on the dark side in the mean, nasty, dirty world of our enemies. Why we would want to fight our enemies by defining ourselves against them, that seems like losing the battle before you get started. But leaving that aside, the reason it's called the dark side is because it's illegal. And what's changed, and this is where it's new, is that it's put out into the daylight. Now it's policy. It used to be policy not to do these things, and well, sometimes you just did them on the sly, or sometimes these things happen, and sometimes somebody took the hit. And a lot of the people who were involved in these things would be people who never carried any ID, literally weren't even identified as Americans in case they got in trouble. Not now. Now you have a public debate in the wake of these photographs, in the wake of these revelations, where both sides of the aisle in Congress and else and across the country, you have support for the idea that, you know, we should do these things. Waterboarding should become our policy, that this is how we want to present ourselves. This is part of the legacy that the president is pushing forward. And it's a combination of two things. One side is a genuine belief in, that this is some kind of, you know, that this kind of toughness is going to show people, that we just ought to have the gloves off. And some of it is a kind of series of legal arguments on behalf of absolute executive power, a kind of totally unaccountable president in wartime. And it's these two things dovetailing. And there's a third element, which is that they, as they lawyered up to kind of create these policies, they recognize genuine weaknesses in the existing international and national laws. So when they found weaknesses in the Geneva Convention, those weaknesses exist. And they drove a wedge into them. Somebody else might say, oh, there's a weakness here, we should patch it up. Somebody else says, oh, there's a weakness in the law, let's exploit it. When they exploit when they argue, what they've essentially done is try to decriminalize torture by sort of running it into a level of de-definition that it ceases to exist. Torture in the law on torture, the criminal law on torture, basically defines torture as a level of extreme pain, mental or physical, inflicted by very intense, deliberate intention. So you've got to prove this level of intent. Intent's always one of the hardest things to prove in law. And because you have to prove that the intent was the result attained. And they then defined his Justice Department, the Bybee and you, these lawyers there, defined the level of pain as equivalent to organ failure or death, which is something none of us alive know. Right? The only people who know what that feels like are dead. So you can't really get very far with an argument like that. Now, this is merely a legal opinion. It's not the law. What happens is when people try to run against a law or run around a law, they get their lawyers to come up with an argument. They go out and do the thing, and then it's supposed to end up in court, I suppose. Or if it does end up in court, you test the theory, right? Is this, and some other lawyer comes along. It's not, I should say, a prevalent theory among people who don't work for the administration that this is, a successful dismantling of these laws. But the problem is they're weak, and they're very difficult laws to make strong because how do you define it? We know when we see it that it is across some kind of a line, but how do you draw that line? And I think that's where, you know, the sort of liberal anti-torture rhetoric gets kind of weak, frankly, because everybody's against it, but they haven't really thought about the fact that it's not just a question of restoring the good old law and torture and the good old Geneva Conventions, because those good old things had these weaknesses, and those weaknesses go forward with us, and they've been identified and pried open. And so that leaves us all considerably less safe. One more question. I just want to make sure in the back there. Well, okay, yeah. Sorry, I've taken everybody from within one row of you, so I thought I should be another part of the room.
Do you think that the same thing happens in America, basically in the military with our own men and in prison system in America? I know for a fact that it does.
Well,
I've seen it. I've been there.
I start the book with this account of this one prison consultant who goes over there, and I talk a bit about his history. And he got pilloried afterwards as if somehow he had been responsible for importing these terrible practices. But he's a guy who had started out as his first corrections job was in Vietnam. I read from him at the end there, Lane McCotter, at the Long Binh Jail prison riot where there was a race riot in the American stockade in 1968. And he then came over. He became, in the military, the head of the Fort Leavenworth Maximum Security Facility. But then he got put in charge of the Texas. He became commissioner of the Texas Department of Corrections in the early 80s at a time when it had been declared unconstitutional by a federal judge for the level of violence and abuse that was taking place in there. And he was brought in as a reformer and managed to bring the homicide rate, which at Texas had been higher than all the other American prison, state prison systems combined on an annual basis, to bring the homicide rate and some other sort of egregious statistics down before he was fired for being too liberal. And so these things, again, it's interesting. I like these kinds of stories where liberal and conservative cut completely against your obvious grains. You know, everybody looks at this guy and sees an old Texas prison warden and thinks, not exactly your northeastern liberal, and down there they look at him and they say he's cracking the whip a little too hard on license, and they see him as a liberal. And part of what I was trying to show is that in each place he was brought in as a reformer, and he was hounded by people who thought that he was too much of a hard nose. He was seen as too liberal by the hard noses. And when you look at this history and look at American prison practices, yeah, it is kind of presumptuous of us, perhaps, to think that we should be in the business of exporting ideal prisons. But I don't think that the policy in this country is explicitly to commit these acts and to defend those who do so. It's just not. The practices happen, but there are a lot more protections in place, at least legally. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure we certainly can do a lot of cleaning up at home. There's no question about that. Mostly I'll just finish by saying thank you all very much for coming out, and all the best.
Folks, at this point, we have to clear the auditorium completely, so please exit. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.